Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. From the Academy Award-winning director of The Cove, a new documentary, this one about species in crisis, lots of species. In the new film, Racing Extinction, director Luis Cejuelas and his team go undercover with buttonhole cameras and more to capture astonishing images. Thousands of shark fins piled up in marketplaces, huge manta rays piled and slaughtered for their gills on the shores of Indonesia, and then the damage we all do with our carbon-heavy lives, bringing on, he says, a massive planetary wave of extinctions, upending life on Earth. This hour on Point, Racing Extinction, the new film with Luis Cejuelas. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Will we change? Will we change in time? Do you see what's happening around us? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Racing Extinction is the new film. Start early on in the film, you hear the voice of Luis Cejuelas. He's all over it. He's talking here about having read a story in the Financial Times about the next mass extinction on Earth.
It was a little tiny two-paragraph story that said, mankind may be causing a mass extinction event. It was like buried on like page 6 or 7, and I thought, this is how humanity is dealing with the issue. They're not dealing with it.
Not dealing with it. Here's a film that calls us to deal with it. Here's Jane Goodall in the film Racing Extinction, British anthropologist, UN messenger of peace. She imagines future generations looking back on our time, on us and our destructive habits.
In 200 years, people will look back on this particular period and say to themselves, how did those people at that time just allow all these amazing creatures to vanish?
What's the role we're playing now? Here from Racing Extinction, Dr. Kirk Johnson, Smithsonian Museum of Natural History, curator of paleontology there, talks about the KT extinction that wiped out the dinosaurs 65 million years ago and the role of humans now.
65 million years ago, there was an asteroid that struck and caused the dinosaurs to go extinct.
When it comes to the sixth extinction event, we have no problem identifying the cause. Humanity has become the asteroid.
We are the asteroid. And how much could be lost? Here from Racing Extinction, Dr. Michael Novacek, the American Museum of Natural History, his estimate.
It's difficult to estimate precisely how many species we're going to lose. In 100 years or so, we could lose up to 50% of all the species on Earth.
50% of all species on Earth. The new documentary is Racing Extinction. Its director, Luis Cejuelas, joins us from San Francisco. Director of Racing Extinction of the 2009 Academy Award-winning documentary The Cove, also executive director of the Oceanic Preservation Society, nonprofit, creates environmentally focused film and media. Luis Cejuelas, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
I watched this last night. There's unbelievable footage here in this film, unbelievable in its beauty and in other parts, unbelievable in its horror. How many years of work? How many miles traveled? You're all over the planet with this thing, Louis.
Yeah, well, this is just in the last week. I've been sort of spewing carbon across the country as we're promoting the film as it comes out of, you know, in theaters. But yeah, I don't know. We bought 10 acres of Ecuadorian rainforest to offset the carbon that we spewed making the film. But I don't know. I'd say hundreds of thousands of miles easily. Yeah, and it took about 6 years to make the film.
You made The Cove that really got people's attention about the dolphin slaughter, kind of secret clandestine slaughter in a cove in Japan. In a way, it seems with this film, Racing Extinction, you're taking that approach global. What's your mission here?
To save the planet. you know, I think it's – I'm serious. There's a – you know – I did 4 stories on the Mesozoic for National Geographic magazine. I wrote a book on paleontology. A lot of paleontologists are my best friends. one of my friends told me in paleontology, he said, when people look back at the human experience, let's say it's the industrial age, and they're looking at it back from the year 2100, World War II will be a footnote in comparison to what we're doing right now, presiding over, you know, potentially the biggest loss of biodiversity since the meteor killed the dinosaurs 65 million years ago. So I think it's the biggest story in the world, bar none.
The sixth great extinction, there have been five already. Did you find a consensus? We saw reports over the summer from the Science Advances Journal of large extinction rates. But did you find consensus that we are headed into or already in the midst of the sixth great extinction?
Yeah, there's, I think, this across the board, there's pretty wide consensus. You know, the only discussion is how far into it are we? Like you mentioned, I run the Oceanic Preservation Society. Just with the, you know, the carbon that we're putting into the atmosphere, about a third to half of it gets absorbed by the ocean. We used to think that was a good thing, but now we realize that it's acidifying coral reefs at an incredible rate. By 2050, all coral reefs will be in a state of dissolve, and at this the current rate, by 2100, they'll be gone. When you lose the coral reefs, you lose about 25% of the species in the entire ocean. You know, there's about a billion people that rely on coral reefs for food and sustenance. So it's a big issue. It's, like I said, it's the biggest issue in the world. And so my aim is not just to cause the, or, you know, create the awareness that this is going on, but to, you know, give people some solutions and some hope that we can overcome this.
Species blink out, and it has happened many times, and we may be building a tsunami of extinctions right now. Here from Racing Extinction, this is Chris Clark. He records and tracks animal sounds at Cornell, playing one of the sounds in his library, the sound of a male bird extinct, and this is the last song of the last bird of its line. Chris Clark.
This is a song recording of a male o-o singing on Kauai. These birds mate for life, so he would be singing a duet with his mate where he sings, then she sings back and forth. Here comes the male song. There's no response. Here's the male song again. That's the last male of a species singing for a female who will never come.
From Racing Extinction. The director, Luis Sahoyos, joins us now from San Francisco. You've got two streams here. One is sort of CO2, bringing on global warming and putting species under tremendous pressure, and the other is direct slaughter. The CO2 part, almost all of us are indicted in, I guess. We'll look at that. What about the direct slaughter? You look at shark finning and you look at manta ray harvesting. I hate to say harvesting, slaughter. Why did you focus on those two, Louis?
Well, for a couple reasons. I mean, what happens is the manta rays are being killed for their gills. It's for Chinese traditional medicine, but it's actually part of folklore. It had nothing to do with traditional Chinese medicine, but they're sold in Chinese medicine stores. And when we began this this journey, you know, well, the manta ray is the most beautiful animal probably in the ocean and on, you know, of any animal ever.
I was stunned at the size. I've seen photographs, but your film, Racing Extinction, was the first one to give me a real sense of the scale. These are enormous. They're boat-sized.
Yeah, they're you know, some of the wingspans are like 20 feet across, but they look like a B-1 bomber flying like
graceful
ballet.
Yeah,
they're incredible. Yeah, and they're being harvested for their gills. And in the course of making this film, most of the slaughter happens worldwide in Indonesia. That's where the biggest events were going on. And in the course of making the film, our team was responsible for making Indonesia now the biggest sanctuary in the world for manta rays. They went from being, you know, harvested more than any place in the world to being a sanctuary. So it just shows you what a few people can do. That's why we wanted to show hope. That's why we focused on the manta ray. Of course, we didn't know in the course of the making of this film that Sean Heinrichs and Paul Hilton, two of our stars, would make it a sanctuary. But it just shows that there is hope when, you know, people realize there's a problem and act to make something happen. And shark fins were...
Let's pause on the manta rays for just a second. I mean, there's a lot of blood on the beach before the kind of happy ending in that one. There's an interesting moment in the film. This is on the Indonesian island of Lamakera. And here you're sitting around with the town leaders. This is their business. This is the whole business at the time that you filmed this part. And they see you as environmentalists and say, hey, help us out here.
Masyarakat nelayan pikir rombongan datang.
And this is a leader saying, the fishermen here think that you've come to tell them to stop hunting mantas. If your purpose is to conduct a conservation mission, the community hopes you can provide alternative solutions. Hunting mantas is our main source of income. It pays for our children's education. I mean, they're reaching out and saying, okay, but what have you got for us? What did you find exactly, Louis?
Well, I mean, that's true. It was the biggest source of income in the village. But now they literally cannot do it. Illegally, they can't do it. They're being policed. But what we did is we provided an alternative. We went into the town and said, okay, now it's illegal. Let's try to turn this town into you'll make far more money doing tourism because people will pay good money to see these animals in the water.
Will they go scuba diving to see manta rays? Is that how it works?
Scuba diving, snorkeling. Sean Heinrichs, who's the star of our film, he did that once before in Mexico. Isla Mujeres was the largest shark finning place in the east coast of Mexico. And that was about 10 years ago. And Sean turned it into one of a few people that helped turn it into a tourist attraction. And now those same fishermen that were, killing sharks are now protecting them and making far more money taking tourists out to look at whale sharks. So we're trying to do the same thing in Lamakera. It's a tall order, but we've raised about $250,000 to turn some of the fishing huts into bed and breakfasts. The boats are being converted into tourist boats. We've got a mask for a lot of the fishermen so they can actually see what's going on because they're perfectly suited to become guides.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking about a tough, beautiful, tough new documentary from the director of the Oscar-winning The Cove about dolphin slaughter in Japan. This time, it's about our onslaught on thousands of species. The new film from Luis Ojeda is Racing Extinction. It brings back remarkable footage from undersea and above, undercover and otherwise, looking at intended slaughter, looking at the impact of carbon dioxide, CO2 from all of our fossil fuel burning on the species of the planet and looking at a new great extinction, the sixth, this one caused by humans. Here from Racing Extinction, this is Dr. Kirk Johnson, Smithsonian, talking about different kinds of impacts.
Extinction is often being driven by direct human activity, things like habitat destruction or overfishing. And then there's global climate change, which is happening in a different way. So we have these sort of dual things, like the direct hand of man and the indirect hand of man in the change of climate.
Direct and indirect change of climate here from the film Charlie Veron at the Australian Institute of Marine Science.
A mass extinction is driven by a change of the environment. And we are changing the environment precisely along the lines that can trigger off one of these great catastrophes. There's been 5 mass extinctions, and they've had different causes, but there's been one common factor in all, a massive increase in carbon dioxide.
And we are doing that right now, have been for a long time. Up and up it goes. That has a huge effect. Racing Extinction shows that globally. It also takes us right to the scene of the crime, if that's what you want to call it, where sharks, manta rays, more are slaughtered for body parts. Here's Sean Heinrichs, Luis Ojeda's colleague in the film, at an illegal wildlife food market in China. He's pointing out shelf upon shelf of manta ray gills.
You're looking at a dozen manta rays sitting right in these bags right here. When you consider that each of these animals has one pup every couple of years, you're looking at literally an entire generation wiped out just in these bags.
The director of Racing Extinction, Luis Ojeda, joins us from San Francisco. Luis, can you describe some of the markets and what kind of butchering warehouses that you got into? How did you find them? How did you get access?
Well, we were working with an activist in China, a Chinese activist that has been there for, you know, several decades. And she helped us infiltrate, and we were posing as buyers. And, you know, we had, you know, cards printed and badges. And we went in and said we were going to be buying illegal product, and we wanted to know how to ship it. And it was extraordinary what we found, that, you know, the scale of it was just out of control. I mean, you know, tens of thousands of shark fins, you know, drying on roofs in Hong Kong illegally.
That scene blew my mind. And I know Hong Kong well, but I don't know if that scale was underway when I was really spending time. I mean, you're on a rooftop, which is enormous, and just fin, just stacked like playing cards, as almost as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's and that's all over that part of Hong Kong. And, you know, but, you know, I'd like to call attention to, you know, we stopped quite a bit of this. You know, the guy that we in the film, Mr. Lee, that was selling shark oil from three protected species of sharks. You know, this is protected by CITES, the Convention for International Trade of
Quote
Endangered
unquote
Species.
Protected, yeah.
Yeah. Well, he had barrels of it, of you know, oil from whale sharks, basking sharks, and great whites, you know, three protected species. But there were seven processing plants, illegal processing plants in the town of Puxi. We closed down six of them. So, I mean, that's part of the point of the film, is that, you know, we can make a difference when we work together.
There's a moment in Racing Extinction where you and your team, you're undercover. They think you're buyers. You're talking about the price for the shark oil. But one of your colleagues, Charles Hamilton, says, hey, pulls you out of the meeting for a minute because your supposed to be secret microphone is exposed. It's a little muddy, but you'll hear.
Yeah, I do have a good job, but Jesus Christ. He's on.
Subtitles there. You got to do up your top button because you can totally see your microphone and tape right here. You know, do you think you saw it? Maybe. I don't know. Were you in danger filming this, Louis?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because it's illegal to have buttonhole cameras in China. And, yeah, and if you get caught, I mean, these are, you know, areas where the triads are working, you know, in conjunction
so
with
Chinese
these illegal
mafia
markets.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, I mean, if we got caught, we would just be taken out back, and who knows what would happen. But, yeah, you know, when you're on the outback of those parts of China, it's you know, the local triads have far more power than the federal government. So, yeah, we were in danger the entire time we were there. I was really glad to get out of the country.
And you're talking big money here. There's a point at which I think it's the same guy, Mr. Lee, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're talking about prices. He holds up some kind of exotic worm and talks about, you have to tell us what those were, but what it goes for here in the deep boonies of this dark world from Racing Extinction.
Biggest one is $44,800 per kilo. $44,800 per kilo. It is a wholesale price.
No way.
They believe. That's why I say they believe can cure the cancer. Chinese, I have a lot of belief.
$44,000 a kilo. They believe it can cure cancer. Chinese have a lot of beliefs. That, I guess that's not Mr. Lee. What was he showing you?
He was. It was a particular worm that they collect. Well, you know, this guy was sort of the Walmart or the, you know, of endangered species. He had just about everything you could imagine. I think he had like 46 shops all across Asia. And, you know, he's a wholesaler, and he sells just about everything you can imagine. So, yeah, as a worm that's supposed to, you know, you take it medicinally, and it, you know, allegedly cures cancer. Of course it doesn't. It's just one of these, you know, snake oil kind of cures.
And then, of course, it was interesting how aware they are of global worry about this. You've got some of these guys in China talking about the greenies and what they, you know, how they describe what's going on. They say, oh, we don't just cut the fins off these sharks and dump them back in the water to suffer. But there is very vivid film footage in Racing Extinction of exactly that. Here's marine conservationist Sean Heinrichs describing what he found in Racing Extinction when he followed a group of shark finners, people who fished sharks just to cut their fins off, toss them back.
One morning, I saw something reflecting off on the coral reef in the shallow water. And what I discovered was just horrific. It's this beautiful tawny nurse shark, but it had all its fins cut off. And it was trying to swim, but it couldn't swim. And it was heartbreaking because it's like, this is what the reality is. This is the thing that nobody gets.
But you see it, and it is heartbreaking in Racing Extinction. A lot of callers for you, Luis Hoyos in San Francisco. Julia is calling from Highland Park, Illinois. Julia, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. My question is directly related to what you were just talking about the graphic images in the film.
Yeah.
I'm someone who's very passionate about getting people to change and to improve our climate, but how do you think these graphic images are effective in making that change happen?
Yeah, good question. That video that Sean Heinrichs was just describing, was it put into a PSA, a public service announcement with Wild Aid, using the basketball player Yao Ming. And that one video that he shot is responsible for dropping the demand for shark fin all around China by 70%. You're talking about tens of millions of sharks every year that are now being saved because of that one video. That's how it saves it. And that's the point of the movie. The point of the movie is that you see this stuff, and it actually, if you bear witness to it, it can have a profound effect. I mean, the whole movie is set up around sort of this cause and effect. You see Sean Heinrichs, you know, going to these grim places, but then the footage doing these miraculous things to turn things around. You know, there's some footage in the film where we have this new camera. It's a FLIR camera, forward-looking infrared camera, with a special filter so you can see carbon dioxide. You know, when you drive
to work,
you
don't see this. It looks like the devil's bad breath coming out all over the place.
Everywhere.
Out of our cars and our buildings and our, you name it.
Yeah, you see it all. We have two cameras. That one that, you know, the special camera that can see carbon dioxide and methane and other greenhouse gases, and this, you know, then side by side a regular camera, so we can flip from one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the optometrist, if you ever go there to better or worse, and you flip from one scene to the, you see this invisible world. Hopefully, that imagery will give people the idea that carbon dioxide is not the boogeyman, some invisible thing that the greenies are talking about. You see it for the first time, and then when it's a visceral experience that you have once you see this stuff
coming out of the jet plane, coming out of the every car in the traffic jam.
Yeah, and it's phenomenal footage. It's really and so when people see that, they start to change, and that's the whole idea. I was a photographer for National Geographic for mm-hmm. about 20 years, and I could see the power of stills imagery to make changes. The first story I did for them was a story on garbage and recycling. This is back in 1981 I began it. There's only one mandatory recycling program in America back then. That became a cover story, about 30 inside pages. And now we started this conversation to create a tipping point. People saw that we were throwing away stuff that was extremely valuable. And I was part of a vanguard of people that were trying to promote recycling. Now my hotel room has recycling bins. But, you know, that's the power
of
imagery.
Yeah, that's great. But we're still hurtling, according to your film, toward the sixth great extinction.
Well, the film just came out on Friday. We can't expect to fix it on Monday.
It is interesting, Louis, you're also dialed in, though, to what Julia is saying, because there is a lot of beauty in this film. You're careful to also shower us with the pure, deep gorgeousness of the natural world.
The entire film is set up as bookended. You see the OO that you described, the last male of a species singing for a female that will never come. And at the end of the film, you see another bird, but it's still alive. It's on the ropes. This poor bird that used to be 150 mating pairs, now it's down to about 20. But you see that the imagery became, you know, one of my friends, Joel Sartori, that works at National Geographic. That picture of the Florida grasshopper sparrow went on the cover of Audubon, and instead of having $30,000 a year allocated to try to save this animal, now it's $1.3 million. But the whole point is that once you see it and you hear it, you begin to have a visceral experience. People don't make changes. They don't change behavior based on intelligence. They change it, their behavior, based on their heart changing. So the film is, I think, eloquently built so that it makes you feel. And then you see the results, you see the hope, you see that imagery and the sounds of these animals can actually help people change their behavior. And that's the whole point. At the end of the film, it's just so beautiful. But because to me, it's that this can be turned around. We just need people to understand and to feel what's going on, and then they just start to change behavior. I've seen it happen for the last 40 years.
Here is a bit from that public service announcement with Yao Ming, NBA, China's Yao Ming, big star, who's really stood up strong against shark fin soup. It's very popular traditionally as a special soup in Chinese culture, but China's big and rich now and wiping it out. Behind him, you see an image of a shark with its fins cut off. It's really, really disturbing. Here it is.
What if you could see how shark fin soup is made? If you could see how each year up to 70 million sharks are killed to end up in soup, could you still eat it? A third of all shark species are nearly extinct, but we can help save them.
Remember, when the buying stops, the killing can too.
From Racing Extinction, the Wild Aid ad there. Luis Sahoyas, did you say that shark fin soup consumption or shark killing is down 70% in China?
It is, yeah. And, you know, we're working with Yao Ming and Wild Aid to do a similar PSA with manta rays now. Yeah, the whole point of the film is not to show people, you know, all the negative stuff that's going on. Again, it's bookended by this incredible hope and the power of imagery to that can change people's behavior.
But you do powerfully make the point that it's happening, and it's happening right now, and we're almost all complicit with CO2 and you name it. Luke in Cleveland, Ohio. Thank you for calling, Luke. You're on with Luis Sahoyas.
Hi, Tom. I just have a comment on the kind of general aspect of mass extinctions, in that for all of the other ones I've studied, the other five, it takes more than 5 million years for biodiversity to recover. And if as humans we've kind of already had a pattern of extinguishing species throughout our history, megafauna and humans haven't really mixed, is maybe it's also that we also have to start looking for how to live in an environment where going extinct might, not for humans, but other species, is a real possibility. And I'm just kind of curious about not necessarily killing hope that way, but how do we actually go about dealing with, you know, a 9 billion human planet and kind of grasping with this aspect of we actually are going through an extinction. These things go through, take millions of years to even actually occur. So how do we even in 1,000 years, 100 years, even kind of study that, even really try to understand it?
Millions of years to recover, certainly, though we've got estimates in Racing Extinction of a matter of a few hundred years. To see huge species lost, that's a pretty giant question, Louis. But take a first look. We've got a minute before the break.
Well, I mean, yeah, what's going on right now is there's a normal background rate of extinction of, you know, every out of a million species, one should go extinct every year. Now we're losing species up to 1,000 times faster than we should be, and sometimes these biological hotspots, it's 10,000 times higher. So yeah, we are facing a mass extinction event at a pretty epic scale, and it's speeding up. I mean, certainly in the oceans, it's ramping up at a, you know, because of what's going on with coral reefs. But again, my belief is that we can turn this around. Because, you know, because we're all connected now, that we understand that this is going on, and by connected, I mean with the internet, mm-hmm. It's happening at a vast scale. We can change very, very quickly. You look at what happened with smoking. You know, it took, you know, 40 years to ban it from being smoke on airplanes, but now with the internet and information, we can speed this up.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, talking about the tough new documentary, Racing Extinction, from the director of the Oscar-winning The Cove. It looks at the loss of species globally, some because of climate change, CO2-driven, that is, driven by us. Others directly at the hands of humans, bringing in piles of manta rays and sharks, finned and more. Luis Ahoyas joins us from San Francisco. Before we finish this hour, we're going to look back at what Exxon knew and when it knew it about climate change. Turns out its own scientists did a lot of quite great work in the 1970s that later got buried by the company. Luis Ahoyas, our listeners paying close attention to you as you describe scenes from this film and your work in bringing it back. Neil writes, we are utterly and totally dependent on other life on the planet. What we do to the web of life, we do to ourselves. Sanders writes, people are animals. They'll put their survival or what they perceive as their survival above everything. More than survival, comfort. People have to be more human. They have to consider themselves as custodians of the planet rather than just another species. And 29er writes to us, where's Captain Nemo when you need him? Maybe that's you, Louis. A little bit more from Racing Extinction. Here's marine conservationist Sean Heinrichs talking about China's role in driving a lot of extinction right now, comparing their role to that of the U.S., where they are in their development.
What's happening in China now is they're going through the same growing pains that we did. But when we went through our growing pains, there was only a billion people on the planet. With China going through its growing pains, there's over 1.3 billion people in China alone. We've already pushed so many vulnerable species and the environment to the brink. We can't afford to keep making the same mistakes because there'll be nothing left.
Josh is calling from Hilton Head, South Carolina. Josh, you're on the air with Luis Ahoyas.
It's an absolute pleasure to be talking with you. I just wanted to let you know I'm a chef, restaurant owner, and I've had the opportunity to travel quite extensively through Southeast Asia. It started in 2000. And not only in China, but in Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Japan, I've made my way through, away from tourist areas and really into local markets. And beginning with Chinatown and Bangkok, seeing the ivory trade in 2000 was absolutely astonishing. And then going to Tokyo last year, snuck into a fish market and actually saw soft shell turtles for sale and things of that sort, which just absolutely blew my mind. And then going to Chinatown and seeing the shark fin soup, but not only the shark fin soup, but seeing the skeletons of the shark fins. So this is a tragic, awful thing that's actually happening throughout all of Southeast Asia, particularly, especially in Thailand, Vietnam, and Laos.
So Josh, let me ask you, how do you put that, all of that, up against all of the CO2 that comes billowing out of our daily lives? It's not so gruesome looking, but the impact is pretty terrible on the planet, Josh.
Let me add,
you know,
just add this.
What's fascinating is that we spend so much time protecting these animals here, but they will go on a migration, and they end up in their waters, yeah, and they end up consuming all this. So, I mean, here I live on an island, and we protect these turtles night and day with night vision goggles. We watch them. We make sure the hatches are good. But they get in the water, and then they swim their migration all the way back to Southeast Asian waters. And then they're on the table.
Josh, we've got it. Luis Ahoyas, what about the scenes Josh describes? They're in the film as well, Racing Extinction, and responsibility there and here. How do you think about it?
Well, Josh, I mean, you know, the raising of meat for human consumption causes more greenhouse gases than the entire emissions from the entire transportation sector. So, I mean, I don't know what you cook at your restaurant, but
you're talking huge herds of beef cattle and all the rest.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure what Josh cooks. He might have a vegan restaurant, but you know, certainly one of the solutions to mass extinction is to get people off of meat. No matter whether it's a wild animal or a animal raised for human consumption, with 7.5 billion people, soon to be 9 billion people, we all can't be eating meat. You know, that's one of the solutions is to reduce our meat consumption and become, you know, to adopt a meatless Monday, or certainly, you know, try a vegetarian or a vegan diet, because it's, you know, all protein comes from plants originally, and the biggest cause of the mass extinction event is habitat destruction, and that's because we're knocking down wild land to grow food for animals that we're in turn going to eat. You look at, you know, most of the rainforests in South America have been cut down for cattle, and that land goes fallow just after a few years, and of course you lose all that biodiversity. So, I mean, I agree with you. There's a lot of damage being done in Southeast Asia, but the United States is the number two importer for illegal wildlife in the world. So it's not just China. It's, you know, right here in America. It's a huge problem. We're working with, you know, it's with state governments. We're working with Vulcan Productions, and we're supporting an amendment 1401 in Washington State. These are port states where we can close down the sale of 10 species at endangered species. So we're working on state levels to try to correct the problem. But it's right here in America, Josh. It's not just it's just not just in Asia.
Carolyn, Edenton, North Carolina. Carolyn, you're on the air.
Yes, I was wondering what can be done besides blame other countries. Well, right here in our own country, we're supporting these incentives for the Obama tax credits in the name of green energy, which is, in fact, killing almost 500,000 migratory birds a year.
You're talking windmill farms or something?
They're the wind turbine farms up to 600 feet tall now. They're putting them in the migratory bird patterns, and we're losing over 500,000 birds a year, including hundreds of golden and great eagles.
We use a lot of energy. We get it a lot of different ways. Our time is short, Louis, but...
Well, you know, at my business, OPS, we had 120 solar panels on our roof. We generated 140% of our energy from the roof. I've been driving electric vehicles for 7 years. I don't pay for gasoline. I don't pay for electricity. The electric company pays me. The license plate on my car, because it's you know, powered by the sun, essentially, by photons, it says VUS. It stands for Vehicle Using Sun. It's the opposite of an SUV.
The message in your film, one of the messages is do one thing, do something, everybody, and just start by doing one thing, like what, like give up meat, or one thing like what?
Oh, vote for green candidates, you know, install solar panels, get electric cars, walk, you know, take the bus. There's a lot. You know, we offer some solutions, but what we want to do is create a global community at racingextinction.com so people can create a community and try to figure out for themselves how to start with just one thing.
You're all about, in some ways, the human psyche and what affects it. You make very powerful films that are very affecting. What's your level of the ratio of optimism and pessimism as we sit here today with the extinction at this point going on?
Well, I think we have a great propensity to solve immense problems. I mean, I saw that, you know, I had a hand in recycling. You see what's going on with smoking. We can turn this around. I know we can.
The film is Racing Extinction. It is tough. It is beautiful. The director is Luis Sahoyas. He's been with us from San Francisco, director of the Academy Award-winning documentary, The Cove. Luis Sahoyas, good luck with it. Thank you for your work. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
In a moment, Exxon and climate change. We talk with the author of a big new report looking at what Exxon knew about global warming as far back as the 1970s. This is On Point. Last week, reporters from Inside Climate News published two parts of a three-part story on the oil giant Exxon. They looked deep into Exxon's own documents to show that their scientists were at the forefront of climate change research for a decade in the 1970s and 80s before Exxon began to fund climate change denial groups. Joining me now from Washington is Neela Banerjee, writer for Inside Climate News and co-author of their new report on Exxon's early climate research. Neela Banerjee, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What did they know and when did they know it, I guess?
Well, from the documents and interviews we have, the most significant evidence is that in 1977, a senior scientist at Exxon told their management committee, which is the top leadership of the company, about the emerging science on carbon dioxide emissions. He said it's from fossil fuel combustion. That's what the outside scientists are saying, that it's going to warm the planet, and because of that, there's going to be very grave consequences for human life. And it was a very neutral report, and we have it on our website. The whole document is uploaded so people can read it themselves.
Was this news? You're talking about, you really are talking to top leadership, like the top half dozen top officers of Exxon. Was it news to them? Is there any record of how they responded?
Well, we don't have any indication whether it was news to them. What we do know from other executives and managers there is that the management committee makes time for only the most important topics of that would affect their business. And a lot of these people are scientists or engineers, or if not all of them, scientists or engineers by background, so maybe they'd come across this in their own reading. But whatever the case, they made time for this presentation. What we do know about the response from 1977 to 78 is that Jim Black, the scientist, gave an oral presentation. He had so many requests from people who couldn't make that meeting that he had to write it down by 78 to give it to them. And then we have further documents that show at least two senior vice presidents continued to stay engaged with the scientists as Exxon went beyond just a presentation from Black in 77 to launching its own research in 79.
Here's a little bit from Edward Garvey. He was a researcher for Exxon, 77 to 82. As I was talking this summer with the Frontline PBS, talking about what the Exxon scientific team knew way back then.
We were generating what we thought was state-of-the-art information. We were doing science that we didn't think in any way, shape, or form would be questioned. And there was no questioning that the atmospheric carbon dioxide was increasing, that atmospheric carbon dioxide was going to change the climate in some fashion. The question was how fast, how much, and what kind of impacts would it have, you know, overall to the planet.
Neela Banerjee was part of the Inside Climate News team that has brought this to light. Neela, even on the impacts, they had insights. I mean, it wasn't a complete mystery to them that this was going to be destructive, was it?
Not at all. From that 1977 presentation to others down the road, and we're going to probably have a story tomorrow or the next day that reveals even more of this. I mean, they were using words like catastrophic. Their own scientists were using words such as catastrophic and irreversible. So they knew this because they accepted the science, and they wanted the science of the day, the emerging climate science of the day, to accept them and their research, because they thought that was the most constructive way as a business to weigh in on what they understood would be future regulation or legislation of fossil fuel emissions.
Of course, eventually, Exxon turned around on this. And here's a little bit from a speech from Exxon CEO. This is Lee Raymond. He was CEO of Exxon from 1993 to 2005. Now think about what they were learning and saying and wrestling with in the 1970s. Fast forward to 1996, the CEO of Exxon, Lee Raymond, gives this speech, in this part here, emphasizing doubt about whether climate change was even real.
Proponents of the global warming theory say that higher levels of greenhouse gases are causing world temperatures to rise and that burning fossil fuels is the reason. But scientific evidence remains inconclusive as to whether human activities affect the global climate.
Neela Banerjee, this reminds me of the tobacco companies who understood the bad effects of cigarettes, and yet there's a kind of a cover-up there that later became the subject of a big suit. Was there something like that going on here with Exxon?
You know, we will leave that for others to determine. I mean, I don't feel comfortable, even after looking at the documents and such, to make that kind of determination. I think that's a legal one. But what I will say, I think one of the differences is that Exxon, when it was pursuing its science from about 1978 to 1986 in full, and it still continues to do science, but in a climate science and climate research, but in a more curtailed fashion, but still peer-reviewed. But in its heyday from 78 to 86, it did not suppress what its scientists were doing. In fact, it wanted to publicize it again to be taken seriously by the scientific community. So in that way, at least, the parallel with tobacco breaks down. If the tobacco industry suppressed the science that its own researchers produce, what Exxon, at least from what we've gathered so far, has turned away from it, or did turn away from it for a long time.
Why did they stick with it when they were doing it? It must have been immediately clear to their top leadership that this was not going to be great, or shouldn't be great, for sales of fossil fuels.
Well, they knew that from the outset. But again, they thought that this was the best way to protect their business, that for them to be taken seriously in any future discussion about what to do with fossil fuel emissions, that they had to show the stakeholders, scientists, policymakers, and others, that they really understood the science and that they were willing to play a constructive role. At that time, Exxon, separate from its CO2 research, was already thinking about and doing lots of research into becoming a more diversified energy company. One of their scientists made technology that cut the cost of manufacturing solar panels by 80%, and their CEO had solar panels. Their chairman and CEO, a man named Clifton Garvin, had his pool at his house heated with solar panels. So Exxon, the mindset was different at Exxon then, and that's why they continued to do this research. They didn't see the research as a threat, but as an asset.
Was there a moment at which, have you found a memo that says, time to shut this research down or to emphasize something else, even emphasize climate change denial?
We have not. If anybody wants to come forward, they can find us online, but we have not found that. What we have found are the documents that we've come across so far extend to 1986 and then pick up again from about 1989 to 1990. It's that period from 86 to 89 where probably some kind of internal shift occurred, and the reason I say that is because in 1989, Exxon joined with a lot of other fossil fuel companies to form something called the Global Climate Coalition, which was basically a group that pushed to stall action on climate change.
That's a big turn. Right. Neela, we're out of time right there. Neela Banerjee with Inside Climate News. What a story. Exxon knew in the 1970s. Neela Banerjee, thank you for joining us. Listeners, thank you for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.